So now on to the Queenstown Park overlay area. Notify the rule 27.5.1 specifies the minimum lot area of 1500 square metres for the Queenstown Park subzone. Submissions have been received from Middleton Family Trust seeking that any references to the Queenstown Heights overlay area be removed. This would in effect result in the underlying low density residential zone applying with a minimum lot size of 450 square metres. I've already addressed the density of development within the Queenstown Heights overlay area in paragraphs 9.42 to 9.47 in my section 42A report in relation to notified rule 7.5.6. And consider that the same arguments are also applicable to the minimum lot size within notified rule 27.5.1. As a result, I cannot support the relief requested by the submitters and recommend the minimum lot area for the Queenstown Heights overlay area should remain at 1500 square metres as specified in the notified rule. The density within the air noise boundary and out of control boundary, which is notified rules 27.5.1, 27.5.2, and 27.5.3. The Board of Airline Representatives of New Zealand and QAC has sought for the minimum allotment size within the air noise boundary, out of control boundary, to be increased to 600 square metres. In addition, QAC seeks the deletion of notified rules 27.5.2 and 27.5.3, which relate to subdivision associated with infill development and subdivision associated with residential development on sites less than 450 square metres in the low density residential zone, respectively. Mr. Nigel Bryce has addressed these matters within paragraphs 16.1 to 16.11 of his section 42A report on chapter 27, subdivision and development, and has supported the relief requested by the submitters in part, which has resulted in the application of a minimum lot size of 600 square metres for properties within the air noise boundary and out of control boundary, and an amendment to notified rule 27.5.3. I concur with Mr. Bryce's assessment and the amendments in relation to these rules. So in conclusion, I do not recommend any additional changes to chapter 27 beyond those recommended by Mr. Bryce in his right of reply, which I copied in a few minutes one questions.
Yeah, thank you. I've got a series of just clarification questions of the text attached to your 42A report to be sure I'm reading and or understanding the proposed provisions. So if all goes to plan, this should be a reasonably straightforward little exercise. So if we go to 7.2.1.2, the policy. Mm-hmm. Where the policy talks about predominantly 1 to 2 stories, I'm reading that as meaning, notwithstanding the consent requirement, more than 2 stories would somehow sometimes be okay.
Absolutely.
And in light of the policy clearly contemplating that it might eventuate, does it follow that a non-complying activity status is the right one for contraventions of the height control?
Good question. I prefer the non-complying activity status in this case because I saw it as being more of an exception to the rule, as in probably quite a minority of cases that a third story might be okay, such as an extremely sloping site where the development might step up a hill, that kind of thing. So that's why I didn't foresee it as being a frequent occurrence, and that's why I went for the non-compliant to reserve.
So that speaks to the discussion we had before the break about is non-compliance seen as a higher bar than discretionary in terms of probability of granting or inherent rightness. Okay.
Can I just follow up on that then? As I understand it, you're saying one to two stories is okay, non-compliant, you're going to be on the height rule. Now, if the maximum height is 7 metres, as it is in Wanaka, how does that relate to the one to two stories? And people hearing it for the 1 metre figure for any roof articulation, but Mr. Faulkner was quite clear that 2 was appropriate, and I think Mr. Williams' evidence is that 2 is appropriate.
I guess to take the second part first, the 7 metres in Wanaka has come about, as I understand it, was because during a consultation prior to notification of the plan in Wanaka, an 8 metres was proposed, and there was a lot of aggravation that that caused, and that's why it was pulled back to 7 metres. It would have been quite consistent on that, given that the feedback we got on that. So I would say 2 stories is more appropriate in Wanaka. I can't actually think of many situations where 3-story Wanaka would be suitable. There may be some, but I think in Queenstown it's more possible that you could get a 3-story that would be acceptable.
Mm, but I wasn't talking about a 3-story, I was talking about 2 stories plus 2 metres.
Yeah.
The real question is whether the non-complying status to breach the 7 metres and to have a steeply pitched roof is, in your view, an appropriate outcome.
Yes,
yeah,
so
it's
said to get 7 metres, get the 2-story house in 7 metres, you'd be looking at a flat roof or quite
I don't think the residents of Wanaka understood that, but it probably wasn't in the consultation documents that that's what you get.
Yeah, that's true.
Would you, in that sense, see benefit in some flexibility in the rules of exceeding 7 metres to a limited degree?
Yes, to allow the roof form, not necessary to allow additional habitable spaces, what you talked about earlier. Yes.
Okay. So if I go to 7.2.3.3, which was a policy you recommended be removed.
So I can repeat the number again.
7.2.3.3. So this was encouraging. And in the discussion in response to the submission that I think supported it, you were talking about not really seeing any measures that it led to or otherwise. But if you could just explain what was your rationale for not supporting the policy?
I didn't see it as flowing very well from the objective. I didn't think that it was actually aligning with the objective. I also didn't see that it aligned with any of the rules that were notified. So in that case, I thought that, well, once I also consulted with our infrastructure, Mr. Glasner, about it, I thought that for those reasons, as he said, it doesn't really provide that much to the council in terms of offsets to the use of council infrastructure. So I decided that this was best from them.
Yeah. Okay. I can understand a little more clearly now your concern about its relationship with the objectives. Okay. Righto, 7.4.9. So this starts getting into some of the questions I asked this morning about what we mean by sight and how the methods work. So in terms of that 7.4.9.1 clause A, the Queenstown Heights overlay area, given the submitter's concern with the 1,500 square metre net site area, and I think your response, which was about the hazards and topography and uncertain geotechnical stability issues, were there any alternatives to what could be said as a pretty crude minimum site area tested or that you thought of? Like, for instance, just saying anything in that overlay area is a RDA with restriction to discretion restricted to things like stability and natural hazard and things like that, wouldn't irrespective of the site area. I guess what I'm saying is, even if they came in at 1,500 square metres, that could conceivably still have an unacceptable risk. So if the issue is risk, why express it through site and density controls, I guess is the question. How clumsy, sorry, it took a while to get there.
Looking at the Queenstown Heights overlay area, I originally, I personally have quite an aversion to anything in such a landslide hazard type area, and so I would quite like to say it's a no-go, but the Octave District Plan already allows some development right in there, and so that's, I guess, what my fallback position was
okay,
let's do that. And we didn't investigate it any further.
Can I just ask some more questions on that overlay area while we're on the topic? I think if there is a natural hazard issue of relevance, we should have the evidence of that presented to us. From what you're saying, there's something on the records and the consenting process. I think we should have that before us before we hear from the submitters, so we're familiar with the background. The other question I have, though, where in the objectives and policies, which objectives and policies provide this basis for that rule or those rules?
Redrafted rule objective 7.2.2, but I see I didn't add it. The word of it, what I had thought I was going to write, was does not occur within the Queenstown Airport air noise boundary or out of control boundary or Queenstown Heights.
Well, now hold on, though. That objective is talking about the gentle density.
Yes, that's only talking about.
Yeah.
And this Queenstown Heights overlay has a minimum site size and a density which is more than three times larger than what it, and there doesn't seem to be any policy basis for that. And I've got concern from the Section 32 point of view. So A, we'd like to see the natural hazards, and that's certainly that issue of the basis for the rule needs to be.
I know that you're short and poorly to recommendation at this stage. Is there any reason for putting recommendation at this stage with regards to that overlay?
Well, obviously, I haven't heard the evidence yet, so I'm more than willing to come on with
I'm a bit of an interest in geomorphology. I read the report that they got, which was a bit of a mixed bag of fact that said yes, there was steam, but it could be ameliorated. But I mean, it seems that we might be making decisions that we're not fully qualified to make. And we go to the density of that site, it's based on the land stability issues that would be better made by someone who works in that field.
Yeah, the Tonkin and Taylor report that's attached to Mr. Getty's evidence that was pre-circulated is one of the reports that I've referred to, but
Is
that the only report that we that there is?
No, there's a GeoSelf report as well that was, I think, a peer review of the Tonkin and Taylor one. But we may also have another one, I think, from what Mr. Getty's evidence said.
Yes.
That
would be useful, thank you.
I mean, the other thing is we've already started working on developing on that site anyway.
Okay, so back to 7491. So one unit per 450 square metres net site area. 7491?
91, yes.
It's the separate subdivision section that specifies a 450 square metre site area. So in terms of 7491, let's just say I had a 900 square metre net site area site. That means as a permitted activity, I could put two houses on. I don't need to make them each 450 because I'm not doing a vacant fee simple subdivision. I could, presumably if I could comply with the bulk and location controls, each one could have a site area of 200 metres, let's just say for the sake of argument. And then I could use the subdivision exemption rules that say the minimum site areas don't matter if you've got an approved land use consent or something to that effect. But the point of it is, I just want to be clear with you that 7491 is a density rule only. It's not a site area rule.
That's right. Yeah.
Okay. So, I'm just playing this through in my head. Why someone would use 7491 instead of 7410.1. There's an RDA versus permitted.
Yeah, that's right.
But that doesn't take into account the necessary consent you need for a subdivision in any event to do anything.
That's right.
And what would, if I was doing a subdivision for 450 square metre sites in the low density zone, what status would that be?
I think the right of private subdivision has ended up with a restricted subdivision recommendation.
Okay, but anyway, at this point, this is just about understanding the provisions. So then, 7410.1, same question as before, that 300 square metres is a density rule.
That's
right. So on the 900 metre site, net site area, I get three units. I can pretty much configure them however I like, as long as they comply with the bulk and location controls. Then I can come and get a subdivision on top of them. And in theory, if I was so inclined, I could try and put all that stuff at the front of the site to leave as much vacant as possible at the back. And in addition to those three units, I could put garages at the back and put family flats on each of them as well, couldn't I?
Yes. Yeah.
So, thank you. So then, in terms of the substantive question that comes out of that for you, how does six households clustered in what could be a very dense terrace house type configuration at the front of the site in any way achieving any of the objectives and policies talking about sympathetic to the low density surroundings and et cetera, intensity of the zone?
new scenarios saying that all of the bulk and location controls are limited?
Sure.
That'll be an interesting scenario.
Well, I think it's reasonable to assume, in light of the expensive property market, that people will look to make the most of their sites.
Yeah.
And so, if there are rules that allow people to potentially put, including family flats, 4 to 6 independent households on a 900 metre site, I wouldn't think it's wildly speculative or fanciful to think that that might be a proposition that happens.
Yeah, I think they would end up being incredibly tiny, I guess, given the 40% site coverage rule. And I think that that's where we've tried to balance it, is that you've got the density, but we've also got the bulk and location controls that will hopefully try and balance those scenarios out.
Yeah.
And also, if you create a cupboard, perhaps you might not be able to sell those. Maybe you will, given the current market.
You'd get a lot of support, though, wouldn't you, from the objectives or the policies that talk about promoting housing diversity and housing choice and all those things. Okay, so following on from that then, the first thing you clarified with me was, would the bulk and location controls be complied with? So does that mean maybe there doesn't need to be a density rule at all if people comply with the bulk and location controls? And maybe the question of density becomes a matter of discretion if people want to contravene bulk and location controls. That's just a direct response to you.
Yeah. And that's a very interesting question. And I don't know if Queenstown is ready for that. I've worked in other locations in Australia that have similar things. But
luckily, I'm not talking to the population of Queenstown. Talking to you.
Yeah.
So let's forget any sense of what people might want and just say, in terms of the questions of the law, what are the effects, what are the issues, what are the policies telling us to do?
Yeah, and if we're thinking about it purely in terms of trying to find as much housing as possible, I think if that's the primary aim beyond anything else, then yes, we can get rid of the density control and just rely on bulk and location and let people carve up the building bulk into how many units they want.
I guess the other thing we might think about is whether the methods don't give effect to the objectives and policies in terms of perhaps enabling too much density in a way that we might not agree achieves the scale and intensity of the zone, which could lead us to the point of saying maybe 450 and 300 need to be expressed as minimum net site areas per unit to achieve that suburban detached quality that's described in the objectives and policies. Do you have any comments on that?
I think that what you're saying is the intent of what was drafted is perhaps not what the outcome has been. And so, something is important to put in. Per unit would.
Okay.
Would.
Well, that's helpful, because that's telling me that, in your view, less density is more consistent with the objectives and policies rather than the first scenario, which you didn't seem very enthusiastic about.
No.
Okay. All right, well, that's helpful in that respect. Also at 7.4.10, then we go into the restrictions of discretion, and I appreciate there was discussion this morning clearly originating from previous streams about that last matter about natural hazard and assessment of suitably qualified persons. So I just want to clarify, there's a question that in some sections there are submissions giving direct scope to change it, in other sections there may not be direct submissions on it, and we'll have to think about what mechanisms are available, but some amendment is going to be coming forward from the council, and that would be, putting aside scope, that would be sufficient everywhere in the plan that current wording is used.
Yes, that is the intention, and that's why it's taking a little bit longer than we hoped.
Okay, well, for what it's worth, when I read this bullet, all the discretion actually does is whether or not someone has provided an assessment. It doesn't actually even say whether the assessment says development's a good idea or not. It just says an assessment covering these issues. But okay, you've got that on board. 7.5.3. So, where a site is less than 900 square metres, I note that here it's not talking about net site area, it just says site. So I don't know whether that's something to be clarified. And more than one unit is proposed per site. So clearly one has to meet both of those qualifications to trigger the rule. So does that mean if I do a subdivision for vacant 450 square metre sites, even though each of those sites might be less than 900, if each one is only intended to have a single dwelling on it, this rule wouldn't be triggered? And in the context of this rule, does site mean a legal title or an area of land intended to be unique to one lot? So is it existing sites or potential future sites?
Existing sites.
Okay. Okay, thank you. And then at 7.5.10, I'm just not sure. This one uses the word section. And again, I don't know whether that's intended to mean something different to site or net site or existing or proposed, but without being pedantic about it, I have had to phrase down judges before, dealing with a whole bunch of very random seeming differences. And it would be nice if we could just find a consistent use of terms. And then lastly, you'll be pleased to hear, 7.5.15, where it did say no parking requirements for a flat with no more than one bedroom, you were saying that's now taken out and gets dealt with in a different section of the plan.
That's right.
Do you know if, notwithstanding where it sits in the plan, whether the council's view is still that there would be no parking requirement for a family flat up to one bedroom, or do you not know?
We've not done any of the transport analysis.
Okay. So at this point, family flats might not need parking, or they might need parking, we don't know.
Yeah, or it might be area specific.
Yeah, okay. Okay, look, thank you for those straightforward clarifications.
I'm okay with that. You've covered it pretty well.
I've got a few more. I'll start with section 42A report. My notes are some of them. On page 20, in paragraph 930, you've got that Mr. Falkman recommends a lot maximum of 800 square metres, and you acknowledge that recommendation. While there is no scope to make the change, would you recommend a variation if would be appropriate? I'm not saying that there will be one, I'm just saying if as a planner, would you think it would be a sensible outcome?
I definitely think it would be a sensible outcome, given the, you know, we're trying to promote the compact city ideal and use the land resources as efficiently as possible.
Thank you. paragraph 9.69, it's on page 27, talking about the density in Arrowtown, or the minimum site size, I think it is. Do you know what the density of the historic cottages are in Arrowtown?
No, I don't. The top of my head, though it has
it
that they'd be less than 450.
That's what I wonder, if whether the 450 is historical or just happenstance.
I can check the minimum lot sizes for you. Now,
paragraph 976, you're talking about the modified rule 27.5.3. I alluded to this morning when Ms. Scott was giving her submissions, and it might be that you need to see what Mr. White said before you answer it. So if you're not aware of Mr. White's evidence, we can leave it till tomorrow, but I quite like your views because he also brought a survey and he raised a couple of issues. One of them is that the average person who owns a site doesn't want to go through the difficulty of getting a land use consent for something they can't afford to build just so they can subdivide, because they don't have the resources to pay for the building. They have the resources to subdivide, but they don't necessarily have the resources to do the whole building design. And then the building design that a consent is granted for may not be what the new owner wants. So we end up with a whole series of variation of consent notices. And I'd quite like to listen to his comments or read it. I can't remember whether it was written or not, so that you can answer that in terms of efficiency. In paragraph 10.14, page 32. Then we're talking about the in the new rule 753, and you already asked part about this. Are the issues so broad that you council would be unable to find what the matters of discretion are? The question, because a full discretionary activity enables people who may dislike it through a submission process to raise matters that are not really germane to it, but because it's full discretionary, and it might be worth thinking whether if that approach is to be taken, whether in fact it could be narrowed down as to what the matters are that could be considered. The other, while we're looking at that rule, clause B, I think there might be a typo or something. It doesn't seem to make sense to me. I'm pleased I'm not the only one. I suspect you might be right.
Yeah.
Yes. Thank you. And the other query I had about that, well, was in the clause D. I just wondered why the exception.
This is a copy from a development right that's enjoyed in the medium density subzone of the low density zone. And predominantly in Frankton, Fernhill, under the operative district plan. So I think there's something like 15 sites that that applies to.
But this exception applies to every site in Queenstown that got consent had a title issue prior to 1995. So that is somewhat broader, isn't it?
That is a lot broader than that. Yes.
There's probably no scope to change it, but you might like to consider that. Now, on page 36, in paragraph 10.31, you're talking about the issue of Eve's allowing the 0.6 metre into the setback distances. In doing that, have you considered the provision, the requirement on the northern side of houses to have large reeds to adequately ensure cooling in the summer?
No, I haven't specifically considered that. I did look at the recession plane angle for that boundary, but I also considered that the northern elevation is usually set back greater from the northern boundary, so you can have some of your windows and your outdoor living on that side. But no, I didn't specifically consider the size of the eaves.
Page 38, in building coverage. It's 7.6. The following paragraph 10.39, you say that the average house size in Queenstown in 2011 was 181 square metres. Does that include the garage, or is that exclusive of garage?
It's exclusive. from memory, but I don't quote me on that. I can have another look at that.
Yes, well that's I think the point of what I read to submission, that 40% of 450 is 180 and you want to have your garage in as well. So in fact, given the two-car garage is probably 50, 60 square metres of the 180, that's a third of it disappears. there may be some point in their submission if you consider it in that respect. Or does coverage exclude garaging?
Coverage doesn't exclude garaging. I think it's in the report, it's about on the smaller lots, perhaps we're not looking for the larger houses on those smaller lots. You know, we're looking to increase the diversity of the housing stock, and although our houses are getting larger and larger, perhaps on some of these smaller lots we should be encouraging smaller houses, and maybe that might not mean the double garage. But I know in the Queenstown district that everyone's got a boat or some skis or something that they want to store, so perhaps that's...
Well, I'm just wondering too, if you end up that you've only got 100, a little over 100 square metres on the ground floor, then your coverage isn't that encouraging. Two-storey buildings.
Yeah, maximising the
return
of
your property. Which then leads you to the point that I was asking about 7 metre height limit in Wanaka, that in fact that may be inconsistent with the coverage and building sizes, but I don't think the average size of buildings in Wanaka is smaller than in Queenstown. Probably the same. Lager, if you use. Paragraph 1044 on page 39. And this is about the landscape permeable surfaces. If they were all located in the 2 metre wide strips around the side and rear and 4.5 metres along the front, would that provide adequate amenity?
I would probably say no.
Okay.
Depends if you're 4.5 at the front, it's 5 or not.
Well, and that then leads me to the question, and I think Mr. Faulkner alluded to it, whether the plan should require some outdoor living area on the northeast or west side of the dwelling, that would so that the permeable surfaces are actually a useful part of the property. I raise this because not every building is built by a prospective landowner. And sometimes the rules have to ensure those provisions are made. Would that improve the circumstance? I think you said 4.5 metre minimum dimension, which would give you a 15.9 square metre area.
The reason why I didn't support Mr. Faulkner's advice in that regard is because he was asking for the 4.5 to be the rear setback, whereas I was a bit concerned that that didn't take into account the orientation, perhaps if you had a southern facing setback.
I think he accepted my question, Tim, that the south side would never be used.
Yes.
If it included orientation, would you be more happy with this recommendation?
I would be. I thought that there would be, with the 40% site coverage, I thought that there would be some leeway for that to be provided at where the developer wants it, but I take your point that perhaps the developer is not actually going to be the end user and may want to build the development without thinking about that. That's not something I considered.
Paragraph 1046, you talk about 3D visualization of the recession plans. And I have some problems with those, and I don't know if they're easily solvable. There were no scale or dimensions. No identification of the sun angle used, i.e. what time of the day and what day of the year. And I would have thought that in one of us further south than Queenstown, it might be slightly different angles of the sun at the same time. Didn't seem to be any kind of landforms. I'm unclear what the building heights used were. And I'm wondering whether the maximum envelope should have been used for defining it rather than just a standard house design in the middle of the site. And the other problem I have is the two diagrams appear to be at different scales, so you can't compare one with the other easily. In my time, I've done a few hearings where shading has been an issue, and it's one has to be quite careful in defining shading diagrams because if you choose the wrong angle, they can show something totally wrong. I'm just unsure that visualization assists us.
Thanks. I'll see if there's a report or anything
that
came with it.
Okay, that would be helpful. Thank you. On page 47, in paragraph 1116, talking about community activities. Being discretionary, you seem to indicate that the building controls or the standards will be relevant. And I would have thought as a discretionary activity that building controls really are there for guidance rather than controlling the development. I may be wrong, I may have misinterpreted what's intended by the plan, but that's been my general experience.
Where I'm coming from there is that I thought that the built form controls are of relevance to the community activity, of the buildings that house community activities, because of them being within a residential area and, you know, the potential effects on the residential neighbours mainly. And so I thought the scale and bulk should still relate to those properties. So that's where I was coming from. But yes, the discretionary utilities do still allow some, you know, play of those standards, I guess, to react to the needs of those utilities.
Doesn't that leave you with community facilities or community activities can only be in dwelling-sized buildings on in the centre of science?
Yes, or larger ones close to the boundaries where the adverse effects are mitigated or remedied, like perhaps the church with the annex building that sits adjacent to the residential neighbour rather than the highest part of the church steeple beside the residential neighbour.
Isn't the church is always the most annoying part of the neighbours, the parking? It's nothing to do with the building.
Or the bells on Sunday morning.
Well, they're not so common these days. But I'm just wondering whether if community facilities are to be enabled, and the objectives and policies suggest that they are, whether it would be better for the objectives and policies to clearly state the what is being sought rather than relying on the standards which are really designed for dwellings. And churches are one. I mean, there's recently been a community house granted consent for a while, and that is in no respect similar size to a dwelling. And the the issues there, I don't think it complied with all the setback controls and things like that. And I understand that it's the appeals of Senate Public Service. Probably the most recent example of community activity. And while I'm on that topic, Queenstown Hospital. Is the hospital one of those unique and one-off facilities in the district that maybe is deserving of its own special set of provisions rather than relying on the amorphous community activity status?
If there's any one in the district, I would say it would be the hospital. Mm. Yes, under the district plan, it does have community facility subzone applied over it, and it has different built form standards, but that was not included within the notified version.
And given that we've got two consent applications for aged care facilities, both of which have hospital facilities
Well, the aged care one's definitely fall into the community activity, so I'm thinking that the hospital itself is rather different because hospitals are not requiring authorities anymore, so they can't rely on designations. But they certainly are in that public body category, similar to, for example, the airport. And I wonder whether the council has considered whether it should just deal with the district health board and come up with something to stay for the hospital.
And the district hospital site is quite unique, sitting between two roads as well. Like it's only got a couple of residential neighbours.
Mm.
So
and if there's the ear noise boundary, why have we used it? Now, page 49, you're dealing with the Ministry of Education's submission, and I'm wondering whether daycare facility and early childhood education are actually the same things all the time.
My understanding from these professionals would be that, that daycare facilities don't follow the curriculum, whereas early childhood does.
Right, but they're different. Do they have the same effects?
Yes, I would say so. There's still the parking associated with it, comings and goings, noise. So I would say that the effects would be very similar.
Okay. And sometimes they combine after school care activities to teach at school.
There's a typo, I'm not sure, it's on page 60 of your report. What's the definition of the noise? Aircraft's sensitive, activity sensitive to aircraft noise, ASINs. And I'm not sure if it's in your or in the original. It says policy stations, and I think it means police stations. I suspect it's in the original, actually. And the question I had following from that, after we fixed the error, is that definition beyond challenge in PC 35 hearings? The Environment Court? That might be a nice question for you, Ms. Scott.
The status of that plan change hasn't changed since the last hearing, is my understanding. So the decision has been issued by the Environment Court, it's beyond appeal. It just hasn't been formally adopted at this point in time due to some separate discussions between the
Oh, so there is actually a final decision, is there?
There's the interim decision, and I understand that, so that's beyond appeal, and
yes.
I understand the court is waiting to issue its final decision dependent only on boundaries.
Oh, yes, we're still waiting for that.
Yeah. And that is all that is outstanding, but until that comes through,
That definition cannot be challenged in PC 35 anymore.
That is my understanding.
And then page 64, you're dealing with bulk material storage. I just wondered whether bulk material storage is just a subset of outdoor storage, or are you meaning bulk material storage which is also inside? Outdoor storage, and it's a prohibited activity. What are the implications of that in the residential zone?
Any further collection of gnomes?
Just changing it to outdoor storage, yes.
I think the definition is quite specific to you, though. So the definition of outdoor storage means land used for the purpose of storing vehicles, equipment, machinery, natural and processed products and waste outside a fully enclosed building for periods in excess of 4 weeks in any 1 year.
What about firewood store? Some natural product, and you tend to have that up for more than 4 weeks.
You might store your caravan for more than 4 weeks.
Can you read the definition again?
Means land use for the purpose of storing vehicles, equipment, machinery, natural and processed products and waste outside a fully enclosed building for periods in excess of 4 weeks in any 1 year.
So if I park my car in front of my garage
for 4 weeks.
Well, it doesn't say 4 weeks continuously, it just says 4 weeks.
Oh, no.
Is that an unintended, not smart alecky comment about what about people who actually park their cars in front of their garages? Only because I can't afford an Audi in that street, I can only afford a Honda. My neighbours complained to the council. Which has happened in Auckland, by the way, recently.
This was in the media here not too a couple of weeks ago as well. It is an unintended consequence.
Great way to get people to stop driving so much.
However, this, I wonder if you could put in mind to what may have been intended by bulk material storage that was to be prohibited, because even then, if somebody will have very large wood piles, one of my neighbours does, it's huge, it would last for 3 years, which you'd expect, but that if you're not careful, you actually pick up those sorts of things.
Yes, these outdoor storage is defined here before. If a person's got a boat, car, trailer, I mean, there's lots of things that people store afterwards on the sessions, because it's the only alternative that they may have. So bulk material storage may be a better one. Probably bring stuff like a big pot of gravel or a truckload of manure that you're going to use in your garden over the next 4 years.
I've got a couple of questions on your summary, which I'll ask now. I've got a whole lot more home use policies and rules. But just on page 3 of your summary at the very top, you talk about allowing one residential unit for 450 square metres in the air noise boundary and the air control boundary. And the subdivision provision that you agree with that Mr. Price recommended was a minimum lot size of 600. Isn't there an inconsistency there?
Yeah, there is an inconsistency. It's an existing inconsistency in the Yorkville district plan, where as land use you can develop 450. But subdivide, you can only have 600 per lot.
So that provision was still within the Oxford plan, and it wasn't affected by PC 35?
No, it was talked about a lot, but I believe that everyone came to the compromise that the operative development rights remain.
Okay. I just want to be clear so that then I hear from the airport, I understand they try to tell me anything differently. Now, in paragraph 15, we're talking about NZTA notification issue. Isn't the issue there that NZTA want to be considered an affected party, and that it is not unusual for a district plan to specify certain people or bodies may be affected parties? Would that solve the issue?
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. rather than start on the other questions I've got on the plan provisions, we'd probably be able to adjourn for the evening and come back tomorrow morning at 10 and then we'll deal with the
Thank you. Thank you, sir.